That's tasty.
Yep.
That's tasty.
Yep.
That. That's tasty.
Yep.
Little motherfucking salad is hot for you.
Don't be hasty. Here's another. Don't be hasty. Here's another.
Motherfucking salad.
Okay, so I'm here once again with Catherine Weber, most recently the author of True Confections. Catherine, how are you doing?
I'm just great. Great to be here.
Great to have you on here again. Yes, absolutely. We're probably going to get into trouble, but I wanted to first of all start with the notion of authenticity, which actually we were talking about before we even set up the mics. It's established at the beginning of the affidavit, and we have this interesting conflict between Alice's divagating tale. There's the line, the passage that, you know, nobody ever tells this family history exactly the way it is in any particular order.
And it takes the outsider to set the record straight.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But the question of authenticity merged with the rambling tale, I wanted to ask about this, whether this was a consideration in designing or writing this particular book.
Well, I've always been interested in authenticity in any story and how we know what we think we know and where we get our information. And Triangle certainly questioned that a lot.
Yeah.
You know, who writes history? Who owns the story? Who gets to tell the story? And a family business in crisis, a family in crisis, you know, there's always the story, the counter story, the way the cousins would tell it, the way the descendants of the brother who died, and so the widow was bought out early before the family, you know, became incredibly successful, but they're the poor relations now. I mean, every family has the lost fortune, the alternate version of the story. And it's very rich. We all have those stories in our backgrounds. You know, my grandmother had a cousin who allegedly rode for the Pony Express, probably not, but he died, as they would say in the family, very unexpectedly, very very suddenly anyway. He died very suddenly when a platform gave way at a public event, which is to say he was hanged as a horse thief.
Yeah.
But the way of telling the story was that he died very suddenly when a platform gave way at a public event. That is literally true, but it's a shading of the story.
Yeah.
You know. And so I'm interested in the way our own family histories are told to us. And, you know, if you know people getting a divorce, and who doesn't, there's always the different sides of the story, and usually you're just really glad you don't have to pick a side.
Yeah. I'm kind of curious about this very interesting irony. Alice has issues with certain childhood cultural nuggets, Howdy Doody, Royal Dolls, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and yet she is essentially responsible for another childhood legacy, which is Zip's candy. So
candy inspired by Little Black Samba,
yeah,
Little
Sammy's. There's that too. But what's interesting is how someone who takes issue with childhood culture then becomes the sort of guardian of childhood culture, because that candy is going to influence all the kids who actually gnaw upon it and chew it and all that. And so I'm curious if
Alice is not consistent.
Yeah. No.
I mean, the book is called True Confections.
Yes.
So the first word of the title, is it true? I mean, how true are these statements that she makes? I mean, her affidavit, the entire novel in the form of an affidavit, is a kind of crackpot rant, and she's just spinning and spinning and insistently telling the story her way. I mean, how true is her story? How true, you know, how true are her descriptions of the history of events? I mean, how true is any of it?
Yeah. Well, so on the subject of the title, it does, in fact, echo many of the lexical blendings within this book, more so than I think in any of your books, quite frankly. You have also the lesbaterian bereavements. You know, I'm curious as to why there were more lexical blendings in this than before. Is it because it was a more, I guess, comic mode?
But do you think there are, I mean, I don't know if you've read The Little Women, my third novel,
yeah,
but there are inventions. I mean, I'm almost as conceited sounding as Al Gore thinking he invented the internet when I say I think I invented Twitter. But in 2003, when The Little Women was published, there is a device called the Click, CLICK, I think it's CLICK, but it's a small electronic device where you can keep up with your friends by typing little phrases and carry it in your pocket. And so it's a click and it's a clique. And I even have a footnote for an article in Vogue about this invention that's called Chicks with Clicks. So there's a couch potato, which is a plastic potato with a sort of Dr. Ruth voice that is like a psychoanalyst giving you answers. So like a magic eight ball, but with a voice. But it says things like, ah, that is very interesting. Does it make you think about your mother? Or that is very interesting, but our time is up. So, I mean, I think I've been playing with cultural artifacts in those ways.
Yes. Often confirming them through false Vogue articles or, in this book, many newspaper and blog articles as well.
Yes, documentation is
exactly.
Interesting.
But this is interesting because Margaret Atwood does this quite a lot, too, this notion of I'm curious if you come up with some lexical blending, some word, and then from there it's a concept that needs to be inserted, or how does this work exactly for you?
Well, It's imaginative wordplay, but also I think most of these ideas are not very good ideas. I mean, bereavements are mints for mourners, people in mourning, funeral homes, hospice. And it's not really a very good idea for a product, is it?
Yeah, no.
it's a disaster, as it turns out. It's playing. Playing.
This also leads me to wonder, while on the subject of what comes first, you have this connection that Howard has to George W. Bush at the Yale fraternity. And I'm curious if that particular detail, the idea of having Howard mixed up with Bush, came into your mind before he had a Yale education, or whether he had the Yale education and then Bush came after that.
Well, it's a New Haven story. It's set in New Haven, and it seemed logical that Howdy Zaplinsky, Howard, would go to Yale and be a very George W. Bush kind of Yale student, same age, a real frat party boy, not someone with great intellectual interest, although someone with intelligence. And in some ways, as I was developing the character of Howdy Zaplinsky, I was thinking about people like George W. Bush, who are born into a family where previous generations had a little more grit, a little more ambition, a little more substance, and now you get the next generation who are born into prosperity and who coast from the beginning, and as they say, born on third base but thinks he hit a triple. And those people in a family business are catastrophic. It's the third or fourth generation, usually the fourth generation. The first is the founder, the person who comes from somewhere with nothing and ambition and an idea, and he makes something. And then the next generation makes it bigger and better and really takes it to the next level. And then the third generation are sort of middle management stewards. But the fourth generation is the disaster, because there they are. They only know prosperity. They only know success. They are immediately handed much more responsibility than they've ever earned or than they ever will earn. And they can be sort of idiotic, like George W. Bush.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't like the Bush family or its politics, but previous generations had a whole lot more on the ball than George W. Bush. So Howdy Zaplinsky kind of is a George W. Bush in his family. So it seemed perfect that they would actually know each other.
It's interesting that you mention this taxonomy, which you've just stated, because I was struck by the interesting notion of so many firstborn sons being missing or dying or being lost. I mean, we typically think of the firstborn as someone who becomes a leader, and most of the presidents are in fact firstborn. And so I'm curious if this was on your mind as to why that little joke there emerged within the telling of this crazy narrative at times.
Well, because also there is the counter story to the success of the firstborn, which is the missing firstborn. Yeah. And the number one example I would point to is Joe Kennedy, who died.
Yeah.
And that's why Jack Kennedy was the one who ran for president.
Yeah.
So you have someone who goes missing in the story, often killed in a war, killed in a plane crash, killed in a car accident, tragically. It's true in the Bingham family, the newspaper family. Somebody dies, and then everybody moves out of position and has to take responsibilities they're not designed for.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like what happens when you lose a tooth, and then all the teeth around, you know, start getting loose. Bone loss. You have families that really become a lot less sturdy structurally because somebody's missing.
Yeah.
And then you have the next in line who's pressed into service to take the position of the firstborn and really isn't cut out for it. And that's very often when a family business founders, when they sell, when they split, when there are lawsuits, when it's the end of the family business, and it just can't survive that kind of leadership, that kind of weak leadership.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you use positional phrasing here to sort of establish that humanity flaunts or moves or is directed into a particular niche by way of whether the firstborn is alive or not. I mean, to me, that moment of the firstborn sons seemed to kind of essentially take the piss out of the notion that, yes, all firstborn sons must be leaders. All firstborn sons must rise to the occasion, or the older brother, the older sister is the one who takes care of everything. And I'm wondering if really you believe that that positional, positions in society are so fixed like this?
Well, not in the world at large, but I think in traditional family business stories, yes.
Yeah. But in business, yes. You're saying?
In business, okay. Possibly also in certain kinds of political dynasties.
Yeah.
It's the culture of the family.
Okay, fair enough. I wanted to ask about the many interesting aspects of candy making that are throughout this book. Alice herself says that most candy factories have very tight security. You, I know, did some research, and I'm wondering how you managed to get many of these morsels into the actual book, or whether a lot of this is fabricated, or a lot of this is speculation.
A lot of it is made up. A lot of it is, you know, YouTube. You know, candy companies have websites. There are incredible numbers of candy blogs, and I certainly have spent time reading them all. I've never set foot in a candy factory.
Uh-huh.
But two of my favorite television shows are Unwrapped and How It's Made. And, I mean, you could put me down and sit me down in front of a TV where there's a documentary on how they make Venetian blinds, and I would probably watch it avidly. I love factories. I love manufacturing. And there's something just utterly fantastic to me about that truly American ingenuity, that kind of mid-century ingenuity of making machines that make things,
yeah,
that made this country great. You know, and seriously, I think it's sort of an autistic side of myself. I mean, I remember my kids being bored, but I was avidly glued to an episode of Mr. Rogers, which was a visit to the Crayola factory. Yeah. I just couldn't get enough of it.
I remember
just
those
love
too.
It.
I'm wondering if you were reluctant to visit a factory, whether this actually was a prohibition, because if you stepped foot into the factory, some imaginative possibility would be sullied.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I also, on a very practical level, didn't want to be writing about a factory.
Yeah.
I wanted to be writing about Zips candies. And if I were to visit any candy factory, then I would be writing about that candy factory. And I don't want people thinking I'm writing about a known company, a known family. But also, I indeed wanted to be able to just sort of make it up in my head. The one factory I have been in that did inspire this story was actually my husband's family's printing company, which is no longer in the family because my husband is the third generation who didn't want to run the business, and so it was sold. But it was the classic case of his father was an employee who married the boss's daughter and then grew the business. But Fox Press in Hartford was about the same scale as Zips Candies, about the same size, you know, number of employees, the same kind of factory setting in a certain way. And so although it was a printing company and, you know, they're not making candy in there, I think physically in my head, you know, the kinetic memories and the experience, the sounds, the machines were a model in some ways.
There's also an incident involving the Madagascar plan, the famous Nazi effort to get the Jews who failed.
Is it famous? Actually. Because most people I know who are perfectly educated, thoughtful people have never heard of the Madagascar plan.
Wow.
It's fascinatingly unknown.
It's there. And,
it's there.
Yeah, I mean,
it happened. It's real. Yeah. I did not make up the Madagascar plan.
Well, the question I have is this notion of a Jewish bakery owner who pretends to be German or who's managed to have his Jewishness ignored by the authorities.
He pretends to be a non-Jew, a Hungarian.
Yes, exactly.
A safe Hungarian.
Yeah. The question is was this based off of the so-called Jewish specialists who Eichmann had rounded up in the efforts to determine how they would actually engage this plan, which they never actually did. They decided to go ahead and do the final solution.
It wasn't that organized in my thoughts. It was really kind of confabulated. And, of course, it's not my telling of how Julius Zaplinsky got himself to Madagascar, thinking he was getting in early ahead of the crowd to get established before the other 4 million Jews of Europe show up.
Yeah.
It's Alice's telling of Julius Zaplinsky going to Madagascar.
With speculations, too.
And she admits that she basically has no idea how he got there, but this is what she thinks. And then she goes back into telling the story very authoritatively.
Yeah.
But it's an utterly fascinating interlude. It's very much what might have been. I mean, if I were writing a nonfiction book about the Madagascar plan, and somebody should, by the way, there is no such book, I know what the title would be, which would be The First Solution.
Yeah.
Because when the Madagascar plan was a happening thing, the Third Reich stopped work on the Warsaw Ghetto. They stopped transports into Poland. They were going to ship the Jews of Europe to Madagascar. But they needed to win the Battle of Britain to have the British naval fleet, because that was the piece of this plan. They needed those boats to ship the Jews. And when it didn't go their way, when the Battle of Britain just didn't really work out so well for the Third Reich, they turned away from the Madagascar plan, resumed transports, finished the Warsaw Ghetto, and began working on the final solution.
Yeah.
So it's an incredible alternate history. I mean, yeah. Michael Chabon's, you know, The Frozen Chosen and the Yiddish Policeman's Union, you know. Well, or we could all be, sitting under palm trees in Madagascar, under baobab trees. And, of course, for me, Madagascar signifies hugely because chocolate, and this is a novel that is about chocolate grows within 20 degrees of the equator all the way around the globe. And some of the finest chocolate on this planet comes from Madagascar. So it knits back into the story.
Yeah. Well, going back to this, the way in which Alice transmits the Madagascar plan story, it is reliant, despite the fact that it comes through several different circles.
You mean reliable. You
believe it because there are concrete facts there.
Yes.
And I suppose you could add one additional layer of the reader now hearing this particular game of telephone. So
yes.
The question is the fact that these facts manage to last even in this endless kind of recycled telling is very interesting and also beckons the question of authenticity that forms the apex of the centerpiece of this book as well. And I'm curious as to how aware you were of such notions when translating facts. Was it a matter of taking a predetermined fact, changing a few details, and maybe this is sort of an interesting test that you're playing with the reader as to whether it will actually be credible or what?
Well, you know, my Madagascar plan information is as accurate as I could make it.
Yeah.
But Julius Zaplinsky is a fictional character. And to the best of my knowledge, there isn't a Hungarian with diamonds sewn into the lining of his clothes getting to Madagascar in order to get in early and get established. It didn't happen. So it's a weaving of true information, true facts, and the true information of the novel. And then you have Alice as the teller, and what's her agenda, and why is she telling the story, and what's her point? And she's righting a wrong in a certain way, because this is the left-behind brother. This is the Zaplinsky brother who was abandoned by his older brothers when they went to America. He was left behind with some very not-so-nice relatives who took him in rather begrudgingly in Budapest. He made a life for himself. But in the end, because he's on Madagascar, because he has children and grandchildren who come back into the story and interact with the New Haven Zaplinskys, spelled a different way, it's catastrophe for Alice. If those if those older brothers hadn't left Julius behind, maybe her marriage would be intact. You know, it's the telling of how this all unspooled in the family history.
What's also interesting now that you're mentioning this is to deal with concrete facts. Alice's perspective is very often counterbalanced by some media presence, whether it be the arson girl TV news scenario.
The accidental burning down of a friend's house when she was in high school.
Exactly.
Yes.
But also later on we see the blogs doing this as well.
Yes.
And it's almost
Alice is doomed to be misunderstood by the media.
I mean, but the question I suppose is why it's always the media or some predetermined historical fact or constantly referencing Zips candies against like M&Ms or any number of candy bars that are mentioned throughout the book. Why is it just the nature of a rambling tale to constantly compare to the great details, the details that are accepted? Or is this part of the I suppose the confessional impulse of these declarations affidavited?
Well, Alice is determined to justify the rightness of all of her activities, all of her choices, all of her selfless behavior over the years, being a more loyal, dedicated member of the Zaplinsky family than any Zaplinsky has bothered to be. And she's self-righteous, and she's self-justifying. And, you know, let's look at it another way. Has Alice ever done anything wrong? Has she made mistakes? Does she take much responsibility? You know, she takes responsibility for so few specific choices. Everything else has been done to her. She is a victim. She is a selfless victim every other step of the way.
Yeah.
Except where she has been truly victimized, she minimizes it.
The white chocolate scenario.
Yes.
Are these legitimate views? This notion that white chocolate needs cocoa syrup in order to be truly stable? I mean, did you...
Oh, the science of my chocolate writing is accurate.
Oh, okay.
It's as accurate as I could make it. But also, cheap white chocolate has very little true cocoa in it.
Yeah.
But high-quality white chocolate has a high percentage of cocoa butter and actually is quite wonderful.
Huh. Now, the candy bars like Vegetable Sandwich and Cherry Hump, I was on a mad Google search to see if
they
these
existed.
Were real. All of them?
Yes.
None of those were made up?
None of those were made up. Oh. Fat Emma. Yeah, no, they chicken dinner...
There was a chicken dinner.
You could eat, there even are photos of chicken dinner trucks that drove around with these candy bars. And of course, in some ways, the chicken dinner bar is a touching invention at the height of the Depression, where for a nickel you could have a candy bar that would represent itself to be as nutritious and filling as a chicken dinner. So it had this sort of cartoony roasted chicken with sort of lines over it, like in a cartoon of sort of the heat rising off of it.
Yeah.
But of course, there was no chicken in this chicken dinner bar. It was just, you know, a candy bar.
How much of these sucrose findings were you not able to include in the book?
Well, you know, I'm still learning things I wish I had included in the book, which is why I've actually created a little writing blog I call Staircase Writing, which is as in L'Esprit d'Escalier, the French staircase thoughts, the witty thing you should have said that you don't think of until you're going down the stairs after dinner. And I'm still thinking of things I should have put in all my novels. It doesn't stop. But candy specifically. So just the other day I wrote an entry because I completely forgot about Chunkies. There are no Chunkies in this novel. And they're really, Chunky belongs in the story. It's also a Jewish immigrant. The name Chunky is regrettably inspired by a rather large grandchild who had to live with that. You know, milk duds, why are milk duds called milk duds? I learned this after the book went to press, because they tried to make a spherical, caramel-filled malted milk ball, but it kept collapsing because of the caramel inside, and they were duds. So they called them duds.
How do you deal with this dilemma? I mean, you're putting the lid on a simmering creative pot, and you can't open again. I mean, it's done. The rice
that's
is
right.
made or whatnot.
That's right.
I mean, how do you?
Well, that's the frustration of it.
Yeah.
But I'm going to continue to be interested in candy and candy lore. You know, as it is, the learning curve was very steep because I've attended the candy convention in Chicago twice. The first time I went there with slightly misrepresented credentials, which is to say, as a journalist. Both times I went as a journalist, but the first time I was really there looking for material for the novel I was writing and finding a great deal. the last time I was there, this past June, the novel was essentially done. And instead of going somewhere to find atmosphere for my novel and find material for my novel, I had this completely crazy sense that I was now visiting the world of my novel.
Yeah.
And at the candy convention, I practically expected to go around a corner and see the Zips Candies space.
Yeah.
Because it had become so real to me as the reality of my novel.
Well, it's interesting. You'll go to a candy convention but not go to a candy factory. This is almost like the impulse one finds in the library, where you grab a book and you find another one there that you didn't know
adjacent
about.
Adjacent reading.
Yes, adjacent reading.
Yes.
I'm wondering if your research into novels operates along the same impulse, that you don't want to have a direct contact with the facts or the information, that you'd rather kind of find the ones that are a little askew.
Exactly. You never know what it is you're looking for until you find it. And
yeah.
At the candy convention, I was writing about a convention of many, many, many companies as opposed to one company. So I felt that it was a reasonable place to just go immerse myself in the world of candy. I get trade journals, too, that are fantastic. I went to information sessions that I just loved. And, in fact, the second time I did have assignments to write pieces, and I had a piece about candy in tablet. And I actually had a piece assigned by The Atlantic that didn't run that ended up in the New Haven Review. But I went to information sessions where I was just utterly thrilled to be lectured by the Kraft Vice President for Immediate Consumption. I mean, I have her card in my wallet. I love the idea that somebody has a job title, the Vice President for Immediate Consumption. You know, when I said to her that I might quote her in my article that I was writing about candy, she took a big step back from me in horror and said, Oh no, I'm not in the candy division, I'm in the snack division. You know, so at Kraft, you know, the culture at Kraft, that's fascinating to me.
Yeah,
you know, that's
utterly
fascinating.
And it's probably something different in another big Brahimi.
Yes, and you know, it got to be a fun game in the Hershey's space to try to get them to say Mars, and in the Mars space to try to get them to say Hershey's. They won't. And those are the competition. So I would say to the Mars people, oh, these new coconut M&Ms, they're a lot like coconut. How interesting. Small bits with coconut. So is this a lot like the new Mounds pieces? You know, and then, you know, when I was in the Hershey space, because Hershey has lamentably taken over Peter Paul, they bought the license from Cadbury and closed the Peter Paul factory in Naugatuck, Connecticut, which is about 5 miles from my house. You used to drive by there at night in late summer, and you see the third shift parking lot filled, that place humming because Halloween was coming. And every Mounds, every Almond Joy, every Caravel bar ever made was coming out of that factory in Naugatuck, Connecticut. So I've never been in there, but it was there. But getting the Hershey people, you know, let's talk about little coconut pellets in a bag. So, these Mounds, are they a lot like the new M&M coconut? You know, you know, it was hilarious.
Yeah.
So the culture of in this enormous stew of all these companies, large and small, utterly fascinated me. The way they relate to one another, the way people, you know, I saw Ellen Gordon, who is the 80-something-year-old head of Tootsie Industries, and I wanted to speak with her, but her people wouldn't let me near her.
She had handlers.
Really, it was like, I don't know who it would be like trying to talk to Lauren Bacall. I mean, it probably would have been more friendly.
Yeah.
And I saw someone ask her if she would talk to me, and she looked at me, and then she shook her head no, and you know, she was whisked away. So Ellen Gordon wouldn't talk to me. But Ellen and Melvin Gordon fascinate me. I mean, they preside over the enormous Tootsie empire. You know, what was I there for? You know, moments. I had a fantastic conversation in a small candy company booth when I asked one guy, what's the most dramatic thing you ever saw happen at a candy convention? And he said, seeing a father fire a son in the booth.
Wow.
Oh.
It seems to me that with such interesting developments, you know, handlers from candy magnates, you know.
People who won't speak on the record about where their sugar comes from.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
I mean,
the Joyva Halva guy wouldn't even tell me his name. What difference does it make? Well, I'm writing a story. Well, it doesn't matter. You know, is it true that there's a Halva pipeline under the street between the two buildings here in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
You know, the Joyva factory. Where did you hear that? You know, this is top secret tahini. I mean,
yeah. There's a career here as a sort of intelligence agent.
And the fact is that Joyva Halva probably has a larger trade in providing sesame paste to other companies than in making their own products now.
Did such sideways hunts essentially take away from the dire possibility of candy burnout? If you're getting all this candy information, I'm sure at some point one can't just subsist on candy alone.
Well, but then there's the Madagascar plan,
yeah.
And there's child slavery in the cacao plantations in Ivory Coast, and there's New Haven Jewish history of the 20th century. I mean, the novel is about many, many things. I mean, it's certainly larded, so to speak, with candy. It's about candy and candy and candy, but it's also about race and racism. I was disinvited from speaking at a community arts center in Cheshire, Connecticut, on the grounds that it might be offensive to people. And I can only say I would hope that it would be offensive to racists, but I can't think who else would be offended by the novel.
Yeah.
But race groups, you know, one theme of the novel that I only noticed now that I've written it, I certainly didn't set out to pursue this theme, is the number of people in the story who leave one culture and join another.
Yeah.
Whether it is Alice, who is raised in a sort of dry, waspy family and then enters a door-slamming, shouting Jewish family. There are the Zaplinskys who leave Hungary and come to America. There's the Zaplinsky who leaves Hungary and goes to Madagascar. You know, there's the Jewish man from New Haven who goes to Madagascar. You know, there's a lot of crossing over in the story.
Do such compartmentalized subjects within a novel, this is the way to combat what some have identified as writer's block, or what might more accurately be identified as disinterest?
I don't really even know what that means.
Yeah.
I have to say. For me, it's always what, you know, it's not where do you get your ideas, it's how do you manage only to have a few at a time instead of so many that it's just a big clog, you know. I suppose since most of my novels do have this kind of three-ring circus quality, there's always the next thing and the next thing. It's not about one thing.
Sure.
So that would certainly... I don't mean to say that I think I have literary ADD. I don't think I do. I think it all coheres. But it certainly keeps me writing about multiple things simultaneously.
I'm wondering if you might have the reverse scenario and you have to put a cap on what you can write about in terms of being able to finish a novel or whatnot.
Yes, and there were things I thought were going to be in this novel that aren't. So I thought the family would go on one of these new agey retreats where families and business together go. Kenyon Ranch does this. A family and business together goes as en famille and meets with a therapist and helps solve problems and troubleshoot. And I thought I might put them all into a setting like that. But I ended up feeling that it just wasn't, there was no place for that in the story. I mean, so it was an idea.
Yeah.
I think I certainly also spent a little bit of time dwelling on the funny possibilities of new agey therapy. I mean, you know, you do have a character who is in a traditional Freudian analysis and then seeing a new agey therapist on the side. She's cheating on her analyst. So it's about that also. There's a lot going on here.
I'm curious, though, if it's not just a matter when you write a novel of drowning your babies, it's also a matter of drowning certain parts of your brain that are basically screaming out saying, I want to know about this or I want to know about that. How do you maintain the discipline to sort of...
It's an interesting question. It's kind of like harnessing, I don't know what, bees to try to get them all to do something together. Because it is a magpie process for me. I mean, the novels are about the things I want to know about or the things that interest me for making a story. So, there's always this sort of happenstance of what crosses my radar as I'm writing this novel is going to end up in this novel. In my very first novel, I have someone lying on an analyst couch also, and she free associates in a not very free way at her first moment of the analysis, she doesn't know what to do, what to say. And the analyst says, just say whatever comes to mind. And she says, can Queen Victoria eat cold apple pie? And it's because she memorized as a child the Seven Hills of Rome with that mnemonic. Capitoline, Querulene, Vimaline, Escaline, you know, etc. So why was that in my novel? Because I had just been helping one of my kids with her homework, memorizing the Seven Hills of Rome. But then in the story, it becomes referential. And what is this cold apple pie that you're being made to eat? And, you know, and then you have the apple in you know, in the Garden of Eden, and, you know, and the association becomes real. But why that mnemonic was in my head was purely because of what my daughter's homework was the week I was writing that.
Yeah.
You know, so there's always that just sort of what's caught in the net. You know, there were all these China toxic melamine, you know, recalls, you know, poison pet food issues going on as I was writing the book. So she refers to them. And she takes credit for not allowing Zips candies to buy cheap ingredients from China. You know, even as White Rabbit candies were being taken off the shelves in Connecticut.
Well, on that interesting conceptual note, let's reach the end. Catherine's a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Always a pleasure to be your guest.
Yeah, fantastic.